This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Sephora stores are everywhere you are, so just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
In Theory and Play of the Duende, Spanish poet Federico García Lorca extolled the artistic necessity of duende, a poetic and artistic force that emerges from the darkness of our wounds. Lorca believed that art could only be great when duende was joined with wisdom and inspiration, that the romance of angels and muses alone is not enough to create art that resonates with our fleshy human experience. It was duende I thought of while in conversation with my guest today, Mojisola Adebayo. She is a performer, playwright, and theater maker who often draws from the deep wells of Black pain to address the extractive practices that have robbed Black people of our lives and environments for 400 years. She marries these histories of extraction with the fantastical, adventurous, and more than human to create art that challenges, provokes, and inspires. Today, Mojisola takes us on a journey from Goldsmiths University to Antarctica, to space and back again, in a conversation that explores utilizing performance to challenge the sanctity of whiteness. What an orgasm-seeking space odyssey tells us about the world-changing potential of queer Black pleasure, and how the reanimation of the life and story of Henrietta Lacks prompts us to consider our own genealogical and cosmic immortality. I'm Josh Rivers, and I'm busy being Black with Mojisola Adebayo. Mojisola, it's such an honor to have you here on Busy Being Black. Thank you so much for making the time for me and for Busy Being Black listeners.
It's great to be here. It's my honor, honestly.
To open my conversations, I love to ask my guests the same question. How's your heart?
That's such a poignant question because I have a heart condition. My heart is ticking really well. And in this moment, anything could happen. But my anatomical heart is beating in time, in rhythm. So that bodes well. My emotional heart is also at peace. So thank you for asking. How's your heart?
Oh, thank you for asking. My heart is good. It's actually buoyant today. I bought my first plant. That's not mine. For listeners, Mojisola can see a plant in the background. That's not mine. It came with the flat. But I went out and intentionally bought my own plant for my bedroom. And I did so because I've been really inspired by this biological philosopher I'm reading, Andreas Weber. Uh-huh. And he's kind of really enchanting me and making me think about my ability to nurture life and within myself and in other more than human things. And so I went out and I found the perfect plant for me, and I've named the plant Andreas. And I found the perfect spot for him in my room. So that kind of small act has really set me up for the entire day. I feel really, really buoyant.
That's beautiful. I hope you have great conversations. This is, apparently there's something really actually true when you There's something about speaking to a plant that does feed your that does make you feel better. And it's something about the exchange of oxygen or whatever it is. I don't know. I don't get the science, but yeah.
Yeah, well, as Andrea Sopa argues, the world like is motivated by feeling, even our cells, like down to a cellular level. Our individual cells are motivated by feeling, not only by some like Darwinistic causal mechanistic drive, but this feeling, this urge to connect and merge and bond and transform. And I just, so this relationship with plants, for as one example, which so many of us are familiar with, this kind of nurturing and tending and talking to something else outside of ourselves, I think is also an opportunity to get out of our heads and into the world again. And if I can ask, you have a heart condition, and that must also transform how you engage with the world on a day-to-day basis. Is that presumptuous?
It affects my sense of it's a very simple, when you say you have a heart condition, I suppose it always, because it's the heart, it always sounds very kind of serious, but it's a very simple thing. It's just a rhythm thing that can get serious. But I suppose that it affects how I think about the control that one has over one's own kind of rhythm and the rhythm of the world, and that there are extreme moments where I just can't move very far or speak very much at all, and where everything on the outside looks perfectly ordinary, but inside my body is running 100 meters, is sprinting, or inside my body is sinking underwater. That's what it can feel like, but everything appears fine. So I suppose it alters when those moments happen. It alters, yeah, my sense of perception of what is on the outside and the inside, and also I suppose an appreciation of the moments where you can be in rhythm with each other, but that actually the rhythms that are set for us are very often do not work for us. And sometimes, so that the arrhythmia really, really highlights that there is a rhythm that one is supposed to be at, the 9 to 5, the, you know, 5-day week, the 4 weeks holidays a year if you're lucky, the straightness, the capitalism, the big machine that we're all supposed to fit in, that often does not work. So my arrhythmia, my heart problem, really exposes that there's sometimes where the rhythms that is set doesn't work, and it's fine to slow down, and it's fine to sit down or do something else. So I'm getting very kind of philosophical, and I don't really know much about this philosophically, but that's it changes my relationship with the machine.
And is there something that you do to create rhythm around yourself, or to create space for you to follow your own rhythm when you need to?
I should more, just attending to those things that keep lots of us healthy, around food and sleep and exercise and friendship and therapy and all kinds of stuff. But I should attend to those things more. And it's usually a red flag. Usually when my heart goes funny, it's usually my body just saying, you're not doing those things, you have to do those things. It's also about vulnerability. I spent so much of my life being like lots of us, you know, having to, you know, wear some very, very heavy armor and be in a state of protection, hypervigilance, just kind of being ready for battle always. And if my heart goes funny, I just can't. And so it puts me in an extreme vulnerable place, which I'm learning through therapy that it's that's really, to a point, is really, really healthy to be it, because we're all so vulnerable, we're all fragile, we're all, you know, everybody is. So to be able to allow oneself moments of vulnerability, and really hard.
Yeah. I'm experiencing that vulnerability, or that necessity for vulnerability, anew. Mm. When I started Busy Being Black, I had a conversation with Bisi Alimi, the Nigerian LGBT human rights activist. Yeah. And two things happened in that conversation. He said, "Boys like me don't get friends like you," which really moved me in the moment. But he also went to places in our conversation that I wasn't prepared for him to go, like I wasn't expecting him to go. And in the moment, I remember thinking, you have to meet him at his vulnerability. And I had to do this kind of like recalibration. And so it was from that conversation with Bisi that I realized, oh, I'm creating a space here for vulnerability. And I thought until really recently that I was being vulnerable, but I've gone through some things over the past year and I can feel myself. So let me just say it, like I'm in recovery. And saying that out loud and saying it to people is such a profound act of vulnerability, to let people know that, hey, I'm working on something and it's societally frowned upon and it, but also societally encouraged, and I don't know what I'm doing necessarily. And, you know, reaching out to my best friend saying, I want you to be part of this process and to invite you into this, but I just don't know what I need from you. I just am kind of pouring my heart out to you in the hopes that something will come of it. And that opening up allows other people a chance to show up for us in ways that they're not able to when we're just going, trying to meet the rhythm of the structure.
You're so right. I think if you're a person who finds it extremely difficult to be vulnerable, then to know that you're not just being vulnerable on your own in a corner, you're in relationship, and that it allows a space between people to open up, that we all need. There's a possibility that cannot be there unless somebody is vulnerable. There's something that's just not possible unless one is vulnerable. And there are many ways of being, but unless those spaces of vulnerability are there, there are certain qualities, there are certain poems, there are certain pieces of music, there are certain smells, there are certain ways of loving that never, ever happen unless that's there. And that thing of the things that we can take to make us, to kind of finally put us in a place where we feel like we're vulnerable, or, you know, something that we can consume that makes us feel that we're in that place. But that is, that might be a fast way of getting there, but it's not the same. And we know it's not the same. Wow. So thank you for sharing that, because here I am in my bathroom, you're with your new plant. Andreas,
yeah.
Andreas. Being vulnerable in our own ways, the people.
Yeah. See, that's why I love that question, how's your heart? It's such a, it's an invitation, right? It's a way to open up. I'm always curious about how people came to the pen, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I read that you started off writing and performing as a rapper as a teenager. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and I laugh because I'm so grateful that I'm so old that there was no YouTube, Instagram, mobile phones, or even CDs back then, so I cannot be found on a couple of cassette tapes floating around, I guess. Apparently cassette tapes are making a comeback, so I need to be aware of that. But yeah, I was in the 80s. I started rapping on the street, fundamentalist, religious, evangelical street rapper. So it's kind of I always have to have the proviso that though it sound being a street rabbi, yeah, that might have sounded cool, but it, there was very little cool about it, really. But
you're rapping for God.
It was rapping for God, rapping for Jesus. And yeah, I started. I think the first I just started by taking kind of instrumentals of hip hop tunes that I liked and rewriting the lyrics. So I think the first was Push It. Salt and Pepper, and the next was Buffalo Stance, Name the Cherry. So that gives you an instance of, you know, where I am in time. But it's kind of ironic that I took Salt and Pepper's Push It, which is a really sexy song. made Jesus it out. But yeah, so that's what I was doing for about 8 years. As you know, in a time of my life of I was a child, but I was also, you know, massively repressing my sexuality, but finding great kind of expression and kind of, yeah. It was a fun time, and it's a fun anecdote. But that's definitely what got me into playing with words and performing.
And so, where was the transformation from street rapper for Jesus to it's so delightful in retrospect. So this transformation from street rapper to playwright, like, when did you kind of realize that playwriting could be a vessel for your creative expression?
I ended up on a degree in drama only because in Goldsmith in Southeast London, only because I basically got kicked off another degree program and gave up I ended up doing drama. It's a long story, but it's a boring story. Because the drama department at Goldsmiths was the only department that would accept me on a degree program. And my dad is Nigerian, and there's just no way that I was going to not get a degree when I had been accepted into the university. So I in the late 80s, I was literally, late 80s, wandering around the corridors of Goldsmiths trying to find a degree program that would accept me. Politics, history, sociology, no effort wanted me, and drama took me on the very first year of their drama and theater arts program. So in I wandered with my yellow and green t-shirt and my red trainers and my kind of faded rapper look, and everybody was in the room wearing black and nobody was black, and it was just bizarre. And I just ended up on this degree and hated it, most of it. But by the end of it, I got introduced to something called Theater of the Oppressed, which is a very heavy way of talking about kind of theater for social change. And that really woke me up. That got me really excited. And I ended up training with the kind of, I suppose is known as the kind of innovator of that work, but he's really just one of the makers of that work. Augusto Boal, who's a Brazilian theater maker and educationalist. And I got into training with him, and then did loads and loads of kind of theater for social change work internationally, kind of making shows and acting as well, and being a regular actor for many years. And then I just got really tired, exhausted by traveling a lot and working in areas of conflict and crisis, and South Africa post-apartheid, and slums in India, and in Palestine, and just got pretty burnt out. Although it was very exciting work, and then ended up doing a master's in physical theatre. So funnily enough, movement work is what got me into writing. So I started writing for movement, and out of that came what was to become a show called Muhammad Ali and Me, and another show called Modge of the Antarctic. So I wrote out of movement, really.
And what's interesting about that is that Ocean Vuong, the poet and educator, said in an interview once that when his students, he advises his students that when they can't, when they're working on a poem or a piece of writing and they can't quite find the right words or the line breaks, it's just not flowing, to go walk with their work, because language is contained within the body, says Ocean. And that the process of movement and walking unlocks or releases the language. There's something about movement and language that is so intricately, intimately interwoven.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And in that feeling that language is movement, is a form of movement, that thought is movement, that there is nothing beyond movement, actually, in human life anyway. That, yeah, breath is movement, it's all movement. And so yeah, if you can move your body, then it will, yeah, free behind, the mind will follow. I believe it kind of like, it's also when I run workshops and that kind of in writing, I try and encourage people to write with their hands if they can, you know, as in not necessarily type, because there's something else that happens when one writes with a pen or a pencil or sketches and doodles that encourages the sense of flow. Or just write and speak. You know, I think a lot of the time people get kind of trapped into this idea that writing is now just sitting in a blank room with a computer. And for a lot of people, that's kind of a terrifying idea. And a lot of the time I say people go for a walk and talk, go talk with yourself, go talk on your mobile phone or doodle or draw, or yeah, absolutely agree with that writer.
In doing my research for the conversation, was the first time I'd heard of Theater of the Oppressed, and think it's a wonderful approach and idea, and was and it's inspired, Theater of the Oppressed is inspired by the work of Paulo Freire and Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and this idea that, you know, the people who are being educated are also they are both the subject and the object of the transformation, right? That we have to put the education usefully in the minds and in the hands of other people. How has Theater of the Oppressed shaped and molded the work that you do now as a playwright and theater maker?
Yeah, I think this kind of central idea of the relationship that you've kind of really tapped into in kind of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that great education is all about a relationship. A dialogue, an interaction, not just a kind of dumping ground for knowledge. And that theatre is a relationship as well, not just relationships with people on stage or people making the work, but a relationship with one's audience, that's a give and take. That really clicked for me, you know, when I was doing my degree, and after 3 years, it was kind of like, what the hell am I doing here? And that really worked for me. And I think that really taps into hip hop, even though I was a street rapper. You know, one of my big loves were bands like Public Enemy, and that hip hop is all about that, to that back into even rapping itself, not just necessarily with an audience. And the idea of call and response, and the kind of African traditions of that's what performance is, that's what singing is, that's what ritual is. It's a call and response. It's a relationship between each other. And that still is very, very much part of how I work as a theatre maker. And playwriting is just one aspect of being a theatre maker, but it's all about that, what's going on in the relationship between the performers and the audience, if there are performers and audience. So there's always interactivity in some way in my plays. But I think that happens a lot with a lot of Black and queer and Black queer audiences anyway, is going on all the time. If you go and see a show with loads of Black people in the audience, people will be speaking, but it doesn't matter where you go in the Black universe.
So true.
And queer audiences too, particularly Black queer audiences. So it's in what we do anyway. And I'm all about just kind of allowing that kind of space. So in Theatre of the Oppressed, it's a very direct kind of interaction. Like, the play is performed and then it's shown a second time, and the second time around, any member of the audience can get up on the stage and change the story and solve the problem and have a debate. So it's not as direct as that in my plays, but there's always space for that. So in Family Tree, for example, there's a whole call and response section. We can, you know, that people can call out names and speak back. And so I'm just tapping into, I think, what has always been in Black traditions of kind of performance, whether it be hip hop or West African storytelling or whatever.
This idea that through Theater of the Oppressed, we kind of understand better that that humans are natural performers. I think Augusto Boal said that theater is what we have inside. We are animals who have the privilege of being actors. We are acting all the time. Mm-hmm. And this made me think of Travis Alabanza, whom you know. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation years back now, and Travis was telling me how, you know, the theater, the way they disrupt this kind of theater experience is through their understanding that the audience thinks they're coming to see a performance, but actually the performance is taking place out on the streets. The performance is everyday life. It's the decisions people make before they leave the house, right? Before they don that armor that you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. And it also occurs to me that you're also speaking to people in relationship through space and time as well. So if we can go to Maj of the Antarctic, which is this kind of fabulous and fantastical play and experience, I guess is probably a more apt way to describe it. Can you tell us a bit more about Maj of the Antarctic?
Sure. I was doing this MA that I mentioned earlier, and I wanted to, for my kind of final research, I wanted to think about the ways in which Black folks have used performance in everyday life, which kind of connects in what you were saying about Travis and Travis's approach to kind of thinking about theater and performance. And I was kind of curious about that, the ways in which we're just kind of doing it all the time, but particularly in Black experience, and perhaps even more so in Black queer experience. And I was focusing on Muhammad Ali, the boxer and activist, because I was particularly taken with the way that he would dance in a boxing ring, which now is almost cliche, this kind of idea of shuffling your feet in a boxing ring. But at the time, it was totally radical, and saying, you know, things like, you know, and rapping at press conferences and doing magic tricks and saying he's as pretty as a girl. And, you know, like, you do not say you're as pretty as a girl when you're a 6 foot, whatever, heavyweight Black boxer in 1969. You don't talk about your prettiness. You know, all of that stuff is now kind of archaic, but I was totally fascinated and kind of in love with this idea. So I was doing a big project on Muhammad Ali, which ended up becoming Muhammad Ali and Me, the play. But in the course of that research, tripped upon this story of Ellen Croft, who, for those who don't know, was an African-American enslaved woman who cross-dressed as a white man to escape slavery, and did it and got away with it with her husband. William Croft was a dark-skinned African-American man. She was very light-skinned. They were married and decided, okay, they planned their escape, but you know, thinking, okay, she can pass as a white person, but, you know, obviously her passing as a white woman with him being a Black man, that nobody would believe that relationship. So that's why they decided in a very practical way, okay, you're going to cross dress as a white man. But it was this incredible odyssey across the United States, and they ended up coming to England, which I was really interested in. And had children and met Queen Victoria and became abolitionists themselves, and just the most extraordinary people. So I was particularly fascinated by her. And in this book, Crossing 1,000 Miles, 1,000 Miles for Freedom, which penned by William Croft, is beautiful, and it's their account of their fight for liberation, their escape. But there's actually very, very little in the voice of Ellen Croft, really, what was going on for her. And for me, it was just like this most extraordinary a performance of a Black woman playing a white man, and knowing that the stakes were so high that to be caught, to do a bad performance, if Ellen Croft did not perform as brilliantly as she must have done, and William Croft as well, but if she had not performed as well, we would never have heard of her. She would have been re-enslaved, maybe killed, etc. We know the horrors. So there's something about that, not just the fight for liberation, but the performance itself, and using performance outside of what we think of performance. So I kind of got fascinated by her. And then at the same time, I was thinking a lot about about climate change, and this was like over 20 years ago now, thinking about how do we talk about the planet in crisis, and how do we connect that with Black experience and particularly the African continent? How do we have that, which now almost seems like we were so ahead of our time now with people having that conversation, but back in the early 2000s, people were not talking about that. And as far as I was concerned, it's like, actually, it's devastating our peoples more than anybody else on the planet. So we've got to talk about it. And how do I talk about climate? And I also really want to tell this story of this cross-dressing. And so I just came up with this idea of this African-American woman who escaped slavery, cross-dresses a white man, but becomes a sailor on board a whale. It comes to England, and in England, that's where I kind of take the story off into fiction. She becomes a sailor on board a whaling ship bound for Antarctica. And so she becomes the first Black woman, if you want to call her that, stepping foot on Antarctica. So very long story short, I went to Antarctica with an incredible genderqueer artist called Della Grace Volcano, and painted my face white and cross-dressed as a white man in mid-19th century costume. And we did this incredible shoot, and the material...
In Antarctica.
Yeah, in Antarctica, yeah.
And Black people are always doing the most. I love it.
Exactly. We go to extremes. We know what it is. We know what it is to live in extreme. We know, we're not afraid of the edge, you know, particularly Black queer people.
Busy Being Black returns in just a moment.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Josh Rivers, and you're listening to Busy Being Black. I'm in conversation with performer, playwright, and theater maker Mojisola Adebayo. She has two plays touring the UK this year, Stars, an intergalactic orgasmic space odyssey, and Family Tree, a powerful and poetic drama exploring race, health, and the environment. In Family Tree, Mojisola reanimates the life and story of Henrietta Lacks, whose cells were extracted from her cervix without consent and have since been used to advance biomedical research around the world. Family Tree is directed by Matthew Zia, the award-winning artistic director of Actors Touring Company, and tours nationally from March until June. You'll find more information about Stars and Family Tree in the show notes.
What does Ellen Craft's performance in real life enable you to do on stage, as it were?
I think I didn't realize until I gave a talk much, you know, quite a long time after that show about Mojo the Antarctic. And I did a talk at Goldsmiths, my old college. And I didn't realize until that point in which I was giving the talk that what she had enabled me to do was answer, first of all, my kind of deniers at college who said I couldn't perform. So the very, very first time I got up to perform at Goldsmiths College, I was, long story short, but I was playing an 88-year-old white man. I had to do a little two-hander scene. And it was a scene between an English old gentleman and his maid. And it was me, and I'm tall and androgynous and a fairly deep voice and happy to play anybody. And I was with a very small, quite feminine white woman. And we had to do this scene between this old man and this maid. And we're like, well, she was like, I'll do the maid. And I was like, okay, I'll do the old man. So I was like, I didn't know anything about acting. My acting was appalling. I was just trying to impersonate Marlon Brando most of the time. But with cotton wool stuffed in my cheeks, literally, and my mom's 80s suit on and my hair slicked back. And playing this old white guy in the scene, I was told to do the scene. I had no choice. You know, it was an assignment. And somebody objected to me doing the scene and said, a black cannot play a white person. And I will never forget the language, a black cannot play a white person. And there was this whole debate that emerged with all the white students basically agreeing with this horrendous comment, and the teacher just standing to the side and just, who's long gone now, and just letting this abuse happen. And I was sitting there thinking, I've got fucking cotton wool stuffed in my mouth. I'm wearing my mum's suit. My acting is appalling. And you got a problem with the fact that I'm black playing a white person? Like, I'm 18 and he's 88. This is a shit scene, and we're in Southeast London, and there's a world going on outside the door, and like, what the hell? You were offended by the fact that I'm black playing a white person. So back to Ellen Croft. What does she enable me to do? Was in that moment when I talked, when I was invited back to Goldsmiths to give a presentation about Modern of the Antarctic, I realized that I had spent all of this time answering, responding to that accusation, that I could not somehow step out of the, you know, that I couldn't, that they had a frame for me, and that I wouldn't, that I was not allowed to play. To play a white man. And I went all the way to fucking Antarctica and paint the whitest place on the planet and painting my face white. And that's what Ellen Croft gave me, that we can go anywhere, that we can be anything, that we can do anything. And all of these categorizations and restrictions and all of this crap that we are given, the rhythm that we're set in, all of this stuff is just totally bullshit. And we can stretch out of that. And that's Ellen Croft.
And that story about the students at Goldsmith objecting to you playing a white person, Ellen Croft and indeed Modge of the Antarctic are reflecting whiteness back to itself as a constructed performance, right? Because aren't they protesting this idea that they're affirming this idea that race, this kind of phenotypical designation, is inherent. And because it's inherent, there's a way it's performed, and it cannot be performed by those outside of the race. But actually, you and Alan are both demonstrating that, yes, it can. Like, I can fool you that I'm white, as many people have done. Like, in the same way that blackness is a performance in some ways.
Totally. Absolutely. And just exposing it all for the lie that it is. You know, one of the most extraordinary things about Antarctica is it's got all of this discourse around of whiteness around it. And the first kind of explorations of Antarctica were all happening at the same time as colonization of Africa. You know, these things all go together, and this kind of selling of white, of this kind of white space and to be conquered by white men, and all of this, you know, it all feeds into this discourse of whiteness and this, and white supremacy. Antarctica is black. It is black. It's just the snow that's white. And that really, really, I couldn't believe it when I first went there and saw these rocks and thought, this is black volcanic land. There's nothing white about it. And the line in Modge of the Antarctic is, white is a cover-up. It's a beautiful lie. We know this race stuff is a lie. And I think that also maybe comes from my experience of being mixed heritage in some way, of always thinking, doesn't quite make sense, does it? Like the exception to the rule. Like there's black and there's white and there's Asian and that's it. But you're a mixed race and that's a bit different. And it's like, doesn't the exception to the rule quite challenge the rule?
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that, you know, there's men and there's women and that's it. What about intersex people? What about trans people? Doesn't the exception to the rule mean that the rule isn't a rule?
But
how does that work? Like, yeah.
I want to go to Antarctica. I've never wanted to go to Antarctica before this moment. I don't like being cold. So I went skiing only for the first time last year when I'm 36. I did have a whale of a time though. that's so funny. You've got two plays touring concurrently this year. And I think you're the first Black woman in the UK to have two plays touring concurrently in the same year, is that right?
It's quite possible. I've wondered. It's quite possible. Certainly, well, maybe the first living playwright. I'm cautious because there are some amazing people out there that it could have happened, but I think not. I think it's quite possible, and certainly the first Black queer one.
Yoo-hoo. Oh, I'm just thinking of all those of listeners who, and even myself, really, like who are or were at school, were struggling, were like questioning this kind of university complex around them. I was at London College of Fashion and I had these dreams. I wanted to go to London College of Fashion because I was going to follow in Tom Ford's footsteps. And then I got to London College of Fashion and I was like, oh, this place is vacuous. I just hated the experience and I dropped out and I couldn't find myself within that space. I didn't see the dream I had there, as it were. And so it's so amazing to hear you went to Goldsmiths and were in drama kind of on accident and have now one of the most celebrated playwrights and theater makers in the UK. It's remarkable. And now you've got these two plays touring concurrently. It's incredibly impressive.
That's really kind of you. I don't know if I'm one of the most celebrated, but I just keep going, you know, I'm just keeping going. And I keep going when they say, you can't, you know. I got turned down a lot in terms of going to Antarctica. I got turned down twice by the British Antarctic Survey. This crazy black lesbian wants to go down there, cross-dress as a white man. No. And the more they put me down, the more I said, I'm going, I'm fucking going. My friends are like, it's cold. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to Antarctica. I'm doing it. I just keep going. That's if that's to be celebrated, then wonderful.
Well, it was definitely celebrated here. I'm interested in Stars and Family Tree, the two plays you have touring concurrently in the UK this year. Stars, the Afrofuturist space odyssey. Can you talk to us about what that is and how it came about?
Sure. It's Stars is the story of a very old woman who wants to go into space in search of her own orgasm. She's never had an orgasm. She's 80 odd years old. Her husband's just died and she's decided things need to change and that this is an opportunity. And the catalyst for this kind of moment in her life is one that her husband has died and she's had a very, very miserable, long 60 plus year marriage. But also that she's had these three encounters that get her thinking about her body, about trauma, about recovery from trauma, about the possibility of love and the possibility of sexual fulfillment. And one of the encounters is with a girl child, actually, who we discover has been through a non-consensual, traditional harmful practice. It's a very long way of talking about FGM. And she learns a lot from that child, and that child's own dream is also to go into space. She's kind of obsessed with space travel. Who teaches the old lady a lot. The old lady's called Mrs. We discover her name right at the end. I won't give it away. And she also remembers an encounter with a would-be lesbian lover in a laundrette. Many years before, and she's kind of repressed that story and that experience, but it's kind of the closest she got. And then an encounter with an old friend called Maxie, who reveals that she's intersex and that she hasn't told Mrs. that before, and that her orgasms are out of this world, and that she an intersex person who has been, I don't know about fortunate, but she has not been through what a lot of intersex folk go through as children, which is a non-consensual surgery. Maxie has a larger than average genitalia and has out of this world orgasms. So it's giving a lot away, but I'm teasing people into the show. I do people want people to come and see it, I suppose. So these three encounters are what gets Mrs. thinking about herself and all of the desires and excitement and all of the possibilities that she's not allowed herself. I wrote it because I've been wanting to talk about orgasm and anorgasmia and the condition of not being able to orgasm, I've wanted to talk about that for a very, very long time. And I feel like now I can talk about it. But I needed to talk about it at some kind of distance from myself. And that's why the central character is very, very elderly. I thought, okay, let's make her much older than me. And that's also why she goes into space. I'm like, how far can I take her? I'll take her into space and I'll put her in her 80s to give myself some emotional distance from talking.
Well, and you've already been to Antarctica.
And now we go into space. So there's a theme. But yeah, so to talk about subjects, I suppose, that are very close to me, but also very painful. But to give them some kind of ecstatic, expansive feeling.
I thought it was interesting that this is an Afrofuturist space odyssey, also because I didn't know, obviously, that it was a distance-making exercise as well, but because pleasure is essential to our liberation, which I'm only just learning. Adrian Marie Brown has done a lot of writing and organizing around pleasure activism, but also Jaina Brown, the scholar who wrote Black Utopias last year, says that moments of utopia happen through the gratification of sensual desires. We open up and let ourselves go. Perhaps we can think of desire differently, not as consumption, but as relational and charged with the potential to explode all attempts to order and contain it. Mm. And so this idea that this pursuit, through Mrs. Pursuit of this orgasm and her encounter with these other people who are learning to orgasm themselves, or at least pursue pleasure, feels like a pursuit of freedom.
Absolutely. I really believe that the power of pleasure, and that pleasure is political, and that particularly collective pleasure. But, you know, I suppose pleasure in relationship in some kind of way. I don't mean, you know, our relationship. But when we get together on our own pleasure, that it, you know, people who are oppressed, to give a big kind of label, but people considered on the edge or powerless or having less power, when we get together and experience pleasure, whether that be in a party, in a dark room, in a dance floor, in a bed, or when we're just laughing together, it's powerful. I do believe it's life-changing, but world-changing as well. We're not supposed to, we were not enslaved to give us any kind of pleasure. The purpose was to deny us our pleasure, and for our pleasure to be taken away, and for the pleasure of others to be foregrounded. Same with queer life. We're not supposed to, that's why our lives have been so legislated. It's what has been legislated is our pleasure. So I think, yeah, it's really, really powerful. And that's also why the show transforms into a club night, because I think it's the closest I get to orgasm with my clothes on is on a dance floor with other people. So I thought it's not enough to just do some play. We have to do something that feels like that kind of collective revolutionary pleasure. So on a couple of occasions, the show immediately transforms into a club night, and I just love that.
Well, and this idea that pleasure is not incidental, like it's not an accident, it's not mm-hmm. something that we pursue at the weekend or when we finished all of our work or when we have a bit of free time, but that it's central, right? It's an animating thrust, if you'll excuse the pun.
Yeah, absolutely. Like when I'm running workshops, one of my kind of guidelines, along with things about confidentiality and all kinds of other stuff, is seek out the pleasure. It's a rule in my work, the kind of rule. Not that you can make a rule about it, but it's a rule, but it's just a desire. Like I just said to people, find the pleasure, even in the difficult stuff, even in the really challenging exercises or whatever it is, seek it out, because you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to seek it out. To seek it out. And I think that's the kind of what I'm always trying to do in my work, is to find the beautiful and the brutal. That's to deal with brutal experiences that I've had and that, you know, many of us experience in our lives and our histories, but to to find what is beautiful and to make beautiful memories, to remake memories. And not just in a kind of wishy-washy, flimsy way, but because I think it's revolutionary. I think we weren't supposed to have that.
I love this idea of the beautiful and the brutal. It's such a, I want to say, beautiful way of understanding our lived experience, our embodied experience, that it's always going to be a mixture of these things as we continue to move towards the futures that we deserve. And I suppose the brutal part of the beautiful might be the family tree. Although I don't want to brutalize the play, but just to say that origin story of the family tree is part of that brutality you seek to address in your work. Can you tell us a bit about the family tree?
Oh yeah, it's the kind of centerpiece of the play is the central kind of story of the play is around Henrietta Lacks. For those who don't know, Henrietta Lacks was an African-American woman who at the age of 31 in 1951 in Baltimore, Maryland, got a very aggressive form of cancer very quickly and sadly passed away. And without her knowledge and without the knowledge of her family, more importantly, or just as importantly, sorry, cells were taken from her cervix. Because at the time in John Hopkins Hospital and like lots of places in the world, they were trying to find the key to kind of everlasting life, trying to find cures for cancer. And so a lot of people, particularly African-American people, had cells removed without their knowledge. And they were trying to find at that point in John Hopkins Hospital, cells that would survive outside of the human body, cells that would keep reproducing outside of the human body. And nobody knows why. To this day, no scientist can give us the answer. But Henrietta Lacks's cells kept reproducing and are still reproducing. And I have been reproducing during our conversation. And they are the only immortal cells. And they have subsequently been sold to every lab in every country on the planet, and every drug, every vaccine, just about anything any kind of cure that anybody's had through any kind of medicine, traditional kind of medicine, has been tested on her cells in some way. So her cells have given rise to the greatest biological findings in history, to quote one researcher. And yet, for many, many years, her family didn't know about that. And only until recently, most people didn't even know her name. And her name was Henrietta Lacks, but her cells are named Hela after the first two letters of her first name and her surname. But a lot of scientists, even still to this day, call her Helen Lane. So the fact that she was an African-American, the fact that she was a Black woman, that story was kind of covered up and she was made to seem as if she was white.
Of course.
Helen Lane or Helen Larson, she's still considered, but she was an African-American woman.
But also, of course, the only immortal cells that scientists have been able to find came from the cervix of a Black woman. Like, of course, where else would they be?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just the most wonderful. Yeah, there you go. Beautiful and brutal.
It's a big task to take on a story like this, a story as brutal as this. What do you hope the family tree does in this kind of reanimation of Henrietta Lacks's life?
I mean, I hope it, and it does, I think, already kind of bring awareness to her. But I'm not the first. There's a really great book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by a woman called Rebecca Skloot, which is a really, really great book. However, what it doesn't do is kind of imagine Henrietta speaking to us now from the petri dish, as it were. And I've seen her cells in the lab in Berlin and kind of, you know, given thanks to her and this kind of idea that she's still reproducing in this kind of that if you were to write down a list of things that God is, whether one is a believer or not, that what is God? Omnipresent, all powerful, a source of healing, perhaps, you know, that Henrietta is some kind of God, you know, whether one believes in God or not, you know, but in terms of this kind of the fact that she is everywhere and she has outlived her own life, that she'll keep reproducing beyond us. It's quite amazing. It's just the most extraordinary story. And I think there's just a massive kind of power in the knowledge of that. In terms of, I think, Black life under threat, as we have been for 400 years, and that to remind us that our life itself is everlasting, that we are immortal, and that we go beyond the bounds of man-made time and man-made space. You cannot contain Henrietta Lacks. I recently met a scientist who works with Henrietta Lacks's cells, a very, very prestigious scientist in Cambridge. And she said, you know what, you don't want her in your lab, Henrietta, that is, Hila. You don't want her in your lab because she contaminates everything. Now, in the good sense, and she's very scientifically, but they're so powerful that if you have other cells in the same vicinity as Henrietta Lacks's cells, Henrietta Lacks changes those cells into herself. They're not just everlasting, but they're the most powerful cells ever. And I think as human beings, and particularly as peoples of African heritage, we need to know that we are beyond what has ever been prescribed for us. And I shiver when I think about it, that of course we are everlasting. Of course that knowledge has always been repressed. Of course we are. And then what else are we and can we be? What else can our inner selves reproduce and become? And everything that has shut us down for 400 years, our ideas of ourselves have been shut down in terms of queerness, in terms of gender, in terms of everything, the possibility in terms of where we can go in the world and whether we can go to Antarctica or not, or what we can do with our lives, or whether we can, you know, everything. That was the whole purpose, and most of all pleasure, shut down. So to just know that, to just sit in that knowledge and enjoy that knowledge, I think is incredibly powerful. And totally liberatory. Through family tree as well, I deal with some other difficult stuff, and it's the wider theme of extraction is the key theme, and extraction from Black women's bodies, and extraction from the soil, extraction from the earth. And I look at the history, medical history as well, of gynecology, and the fact that Western gynecology comes from experiments, non-consensual experiments on African-American women. And I also look at extraction now and extraction of Black life in terms of medical workers and the NHS. And because I wrote the play during COVID, so I was thinking about the lack of recognition for Black nurses and doctors. So I have these other stories running through, and Henrietta's at the center of it. But I think she's at the center of it because there is, I think, enormous power and enormous hope in that. And that it's imagination, but it's science. It's like, you can also really prove it. So when science gives you something that is more than you could imagine, then what then could be imagined for the future? And is this notion of a future a construct? I think it is a construct. The future and the past is a construct, that we are beyond this time. And one of the most profound moments in Family Tree is when Henrietta has a conversation with a tree, because she's angry, because she's seen the history of gynecology through these plays, and she's watching these other scenes in the play. And she addresses a tree, and she says to this tree, all this time I took you for my ancient friend. like I sat beneath you and suckled my baby at your breast, and you let us down. You saw tree, everything that happened, and how could it be that nature let us down? And the tree itself, which speaks back in this kind of androgynous black tones, and I imagined the amazing trans artist Vaginal Davis being the voice of the tree. I don't know if she would ever say yes, but anyway, shout out Badge if you're there, please do it. So the tree speaks back to Henrietta Lacks and tells her, you're thinking in man-made time. Think with trees and things will feel completely different. And perhaps that's for you as well, Josh, thinking with Andreas, thinking with your plant, thinking beyond the man-made, I think gives us great power and hope that we are beyond time, that the oldest tree in the world is like 95,000 years old. Let's think with trees. Let's think out of the man-made. Let's think out of everything that's ever been constructed for us, because Henrietta is in all of us. All of us is in all of us. Everything is everything. And we could just, yeah. I just feel so good talking to you. Thank you.
Mojisola Adebayo is a Black British performer, playwright, director, producer, workshop leader, and teacher of Yoruba and Danish heritage. Over the past 25 years, she has worked on various theater and performance projects from Antarctica to Zimbabwe. She has acted in over 50 theater, television, and radio productions, and devised and directed over 30 scripts for stage and video. Busy Being Black is an exploration and expression of queer liveliness. And my guests are those who have learned to live, love, and thrive at the intersection of their identities. Your support of the show means the world. Please leave a rating and a review and share these conversations far and wide. As we continue to work towards futures worthy of us all, my hope is that as many of you as possible understand Busy Being Black as a soft, tender, and intellectually rigorous place for you all to land. Thank you to my friend Lazarus Lynch for creating the ancestral and enlivening Busy Being Black theme music.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.